I propose that we resume. We're now back to ATM. We have an interesting application. Open source avant la lettre, I call it, and it will be presented by Garfield Dean. Garfield, please.
Hi. Just a little bit of background about myself. I'm someone who's very much a TCAS expert, working in ATM for about 20 years, first 10 of which was roughly on expert systems, artificial intelligence in air traffic control, and subsequently the last 10 years approximately has been on a system called TCAS. It's Traffic Alert and Collision Avoidance System, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it as I go through.
I understood that we will receive the crossing. As I said, many people are not too familiar with
it. I hope that most of these things will be explained, even if one of the slides is in Japanese to help you. I'm also a user of open source, so in the spirit of the affair, this was created with OpenOffice. So I'll tell you roughly what TCAS is, a little bit about the history of its development, and then I'll try and compare and contrast it with OSS and bring up some of the questions that were put forward in the material given to everybody. I'll address some of those questions. And finally, just speculation where OSS might be used, might be first used in ATM. So there we go, there's TCAS, tells you everything. It's an equipment on an aircraft that tells a pilot to climb or descend when there's a risk of a collision with another aircraft.
This is the one that was overridden by the air traffic controller in Switzerland and caused a crash.
Absolutely, yes, that's the one. It's exactly that piece of equipment. Yes, sorry.
Yeah, there is one wrong mark, the TCAS code.
Yeah, right, that's what I'm saying, the human was wrong.
Yeah, the controller.
Right, the human was wrong. Well, overrode
with
the software.
I think we should give Garfield, who's also aware of the accident report, the chance to elaborate.
It depends where you limit the system. Do you include the controller and pilot in the system or not? The smaller technical system was right, the larger social system was not correct. The TCAS uses a radar on board the aircraft called a transponder, and it measures distance to other aircraft and gets information on altitude. And based solely on that information, obtained once a second, it's able to perform collision avoidance. And it has a collision avoidance algorithm. It's defined by pseudocode and completely identical state charts. They're a cross-check, one to the other. I will argue that this pseudocode and state charts, which is actually a standard, has some similarities with OSS. It's not OSS, but it has some similarities. Just to show you what TCAS is, there's a display for a pilot. In this case, it's telling the pilot, whatever you do, don't descend. And it would probably have an oral enunciation of, adjust vertical speed, adjust, in a very good American accent, and notably in a male American accent for the Saudi Arabians and a female for most of the rest of the world. It has a simple control panel as well, and that's physically, it's packed into a load of boxes with a sort of number of antennas and things that are shoved up on the screen. How was it developed? Well, initially it was developed in the 1950s. This is 1950s technology. And it was just a dream in a few engineers' eyes until about the 1970s. And numerous occasions of being cancelled and reinstated. And then there was a collision in sort of California, and suddenly Congress got interested and said, we want a collision avoidance system. The fact that this collision avoidance system couldn't have avoided that particular collision didn't come into it. They wanted a collision avoidance system. So suddenly TCAS became topic of the month. We're going to implement it. We're going to have it working and put on all major aircraft that come into the United States. Now, aircraft come into the United States from all over the world, so suddenly you've got a worldwide system. And for that reason, the FAA had to develop international standards, not just something that a group of their own engineers knocked up. They had to have cooperation and agreement from people in countries all over the world, and they had to get a group of manufacturers, ideally from all over the world as well, to implement the set of specifications that were put forward. As I say, this really is an international system. It's all very nice if you have two separate collision avoidance systems that work with different algorithms, But what happens if they're different algorithms, one of them says climb and the other one says climb as well? You've got a real problem. So you have to have coordination between the systems, you have to have agreed sets of rules on how these things are going to work. So there are two sets of standards that were created. First is the ICAO, International Civil Aviation Organization standards, are very much high-level performance standards. They are open to slight different interpretations. It's really what percentage of conflicts will the system be able to resolve? How many false alerts will it generate? It's also about interoperability requirements, and it says nothing about displays, nothing about a lot of the practical details of implementation. And this was decided by committee, needing consensus. So it had delegates from the ICAO member states, in other words, potentially all states worldwide. But in practice, there was a handful, sort of half a dozen states that were really interested in it, and a couple of organisations like the Pilots and Controllers Unions and also Eurocontrol and the like. ICAO is slow, painfully slow. So by no means was this driving events, it was very much responding to events of the underlying development of the system. But it was a good forum for people who were doing underlying validation work to point out problems. It was here a chance, it was a check and a balance to say, if something really was going wrong with the software, we can at this stage stop it, we can point it out, here are the flaws, here are cases where it's really going to go wrong. But in practice, it was working on what the detailed design was all about. It was just providing a more abstract international flavour for the detailed design. And many of the same people were on the two groups. And RTCA did the detailed work. This is the sort of very high-level sort of description, overview of TCAS. I just show it to you. Doesn't really matter what it shows. It's just nice high-level structured diagrams. That's the sort of flavour of ICAO. So what are the RTCA TCAS standards? Well, they're detailed design requirements. You have display descriptions in all of its gory detail, architectural designs. In particular, you have a lot of explanatory text, but the heart of it is pseudocode and state charts. It's hierarchically organized, so it's easier to read. But it's not code, but it's very, very close to it. So you do have different implementations. Individual manufacturers have to actually take the pseudocode and then code it in C or Ada or whatever your favourite language is of the moment.
Is there a test suite that comes with it to verify compliance?
Absolutely. There is a very detailed set of tests that are defined to go with that software to ensure that it does comply. Again, all of this was defined by a committee needing consensus. However, it's very much a political body, RTCA. At the highest level, it's very strongly influenced by the FAA, and they select the chairman of the individual group, and the chairman comes under a lot of political influences from different areas, from the airline industry, from pilots, from controllers, also from manufacturers. In theory, anyone is welcome, but they have to show their competence. There are many different viewpoints, some of whom completely opposed to the idea, absolutely dead set against it. If I say that there was one cargo carrier that did not want to have the bloody system at all, and they were present in quite a few of the meetings, could be considered as disruptive, but in other ways they were actually very helpful because some of their arguments were actually valid. The system was initially very fluid. Initially, it was very easy to incorporate any changes whatsoever into the design. Anybody came up with an idea, it was considered, it was discussed on its merits. If it was appropriate, it was put into the design. If it wasn't, it was thrown out, or there were evaluations done by other teams. And there were many teams. Even within the United States, there were teams developing what they thought was good for the logic. There were teams that were evaluating how it worked. People that were developing alternative representations, that was the state charts. And then in Europe, there was also testing going on, independent validation of some of the algorithms. There were checking with European data as opposed to United States data. And all of these inputs were being put into RTCA. But RTCA, the decision-making process, seemed a bit like fighting in the fog, or fighting against the fog. You really didn't seem to know how decisions were made. It is how it was described to me by one delegate. It's trying to get consensus, but at the same time, there was ultimately a power base which came from the FAA. They could impose their ideas onto the direction to suit their particular needs. All of this flexibility went away very, very rapidly once the system was implemented. You have to know that to change just the software on an aircraft costs $5,000. No hardware change, just going in, plugging in a new ROM card or whatever, downloading from a plug-in source, no hardware change whatsoever. Airline companies will be charged $5,000 per aircraft for that because of the certification issues, because of practical downtime and making the various staff travel all over the place.
That's actually quite cheap.
That's inexpensive, but it still needs to be justified, and that's just for a software change. And if you consider that there are 10,000 aircraft in and around Europe that require this software, it's €50 million, $50 million, more or less the same. So people were rather reluctant to do any changes. Plus, there's also the development costs as well of any subsequent development. Just to show how close this is to normal code, I mean, all of the variables are actually defined somewhere else in the text, but it's very close to something like a C-type code, C or BASIC or something. The state charts are just an alternative way of saying exactly the same thing, and it was done as part of validating the whole software concept. Again, this shows that people were quite open to what, at the time, and this is sort of 15, 20 years ago, were really very innovative ideas. So how does this software development compare with OSS? Well, it's not code. Pseudocode is not code. There are at least 5 different implementations of this same pseudocode. And as you pointed out, you need stringent testing standards, and those are made available. The second major difference was that most, if not all, of the participants were paid. They represented many different interest groups. So there were the designers of the system, there were regulators of air traffic management, manufacturers, airlines, pilots, controllers. Now, some of these actually effectively were giving their time. For example, people in the pilots union, they pay a regular percentage of their salary, and then the people who actually attend the meetings are reimbursed for their time and effort. Nevertheless, it is actually the pilots are putting their own money into this. The same is true of the manufacturers, the airlines, etc. There really was, everybody was putting effort in, but the individuals were getting paid. The process was and still is open for anyone to contribute. And those that put in the effort, those that are prepared to make the time and effort, will be heard. Even those that objected, as I said. Now, although TCAS is a safety system, it's not a safety critical system. And a question that I have for you is, would an open source software version of a safety critical system be acceptable?
So this is level E, EL170B?
No, it isn't. It's classified as B, but it's arguable that it only needs to be level C. If your TCAS system continually generates false alerts, then it's a hazard. But if your TCAS system just falls over, crashes and dies and does nothing, you're just back to the safety level that you were at before. It hasn't induced any new risk. If you couple it directly to your autopilot, it might be something else. Right. Responsibility for TCAS units is with the manufacturers. So if you have a collision such as Überlingen, who is responsible for any problems that there might have been in the TCAS logic? And arguably, there are problems in the TCAS logic which are currently being updated as a result of Überlingen. Now, the FAA nominally absolves manufacturers of design flaws in the logic. And in theory, the FAA can't be sued for this, is what I've been told. Now, I'm sure that will be tried out in the courts over Überlingen. Who is going to be testing claims about the TCAS logic? And suppose there really was a flaw in the TCAS logic, a serious flaw in it, and we know that TCAS is going to create collisions that weren't there previously. In the same way that people are inoculated against disease, some very small percentage of them will actually have an adverse reaction and die as a result of the inoculation. So is the case with TCAS that in a very small percentage of cases you actually create collisions where they weren't there before. So who's going to take the responsibility? And the same is going to be true with any other form of safety critical software.
Excuse me, yes. But was this known before as a fault of the algorithm, or was it detected due to the...
It's inherent. It's inherent within the system. The argument is, very briefly, is something like this. Without TCAS, you would have, in a period of time in an airspace, you would have, let's say, 5 mid-air collisions. With TCAS, in the same period of time, you will have 2 collisions that are left. So TCAS has reduced it by a factor, a very considerable factor. However, of those 2 collisions that are left, one of them wouldn't have been a collision if you hadn't had TCAS at all on board. It was created where there wasn't one beforehand. You've still improved the overall situation, but one of the collisions has been induced by the system. So you have an overall benefit, but you nevertheless have created a problem where there wasn't one beforehand.
And presumably Uberlingen falls into that category, because if neither aircraft had had TCAS, they'd both obeyed the ATC and wouldn't hit each other.
Absolutely, yes.
It wasn't down to a fault in the logic of TCAS, because TCAS worked exactly as it was designed to. Well, it was, the problem was that, in a sense, TCAS told one aircraft to ascend and the other aircraft ascended because of the ATC doesn't.
Well, you can still argue that there was a weakness in the logic. I won't call it a flaw, in that you could have said, well, because TCAS knew all the way down to the point of collision that the two aircraft were going to collide, and yet it did nothing about it. It could have possibly reversed the sense of one of the two aircraft, in particular if it had reversed the sense of the aircraft that was following the resolution advisory, then arguably it would have continued to follow and would have reversed, whereas the other one would have said, oh right, TCAS is now telling me to do what I'm doing anyway, so I'll carry on doing it. You cannot program a collision avoidance system against a guided missile. If the other aircraft is deliberately manoeuvring against you, there's nothing you can do. But it would have given an extra chance that that wasn't there. Again, comparison with OSS. You have to pay to get the RTCA documents. The amount that you have to pay is pretty trivial. It's a few hundred dollars, and if you're selling several thousand systems at $100,000 a time, it's no big deal if you're a manufacturer. But if I'm an individual off the street and I want to get a hold of this, I'm not sure that I want to pay a few hundred dollars and get involved in this. It's a hurdle there, but this is the way that RTCA actually makes its money. So there's questions about funding the standard setting organisation, or the people that are doing the overall coordination, if you like, the people responsible. The feedback from user experience has been incorporated into upgrades. There's a first version of the system wasn't good. It had a design bug, and after the initial release there have been 2 upgrades, and there's one more planned, and maybe there'll even be another one. Individual manufacturers have added their own features. So compare this with sort of Red Hat or SUSE, who sort of have their own particular brand and style, even if it's only changing the colour of the screen when you start it up, and their mini upgrades. However, the manufacturers do this by themselves. They don't feed back most of these changes. It's their proprietary aspect of the software, as described by Philips. They want to have their selling points. Just some of the questions that were brought up and distributed to all of the authors, and some thoughts on those. It's not just the motivation of the developers that count in this. There are many interested parties. Budget holders in particular, in airlines and ATM authorities, need the motivation to use a software even if it's free. For example, in another area I distribute a free analysis software for examining TCAS events. And there are some authorities that want to use it and others that don't. It costs personnel to use this. There was a question about security symmetry. The way that TCAS gets around this is with hardware. There are physical measurements that are taken, and these tell you definitively whether somebody is trying to spoof you or not, to tell you that they are at such and such an altitude, at such and such a distance, and to make you have false alerts. This is the way that TCAS is physically measuring things. It's hard to con it. The practical collaboration is now taking place with teleconferences. a website and sort of a wiki type thing as well, email, and we have the great luxury of regular meetings. But these really do help to understand the people, have a drink, have a beer with the people. It makes a hell of a difference. We welcome criticism, try not to take it personally, and we feel that that's the way that we're going to get the good peer review. Have good faith in people that are around. One of the areas that's very noticeable was a substantial effort to develop evaluation criteria and software tools. If I say that the system, TCAS itself, perhaps cost $50 million, $100 million to develop, about $1 million or a couple of million dollars were put just on developing the evaluation criteria. It's quite a substantial suite. It's definitely been worthwhile. No, the quote is, how do you know you've improved something you can't measure? I think we need to accept that there are different motivations for working on it. Even those that were trying to break it, God help Bob Hilb, probably helped it, helped make it robust. It let people really think through the arguments and what needs to be sold to other people. And finally, there have been competing demands. There's different requirements in European airspace from US airspace. The way that the system operates is really substantially different. And you have to set your parameters for the system to make some sort of compromise. Who is it that's going to decide on that compromise? How is it thrashed out? Ultimately, who is it that's going to say, we take this set of figures rather than another set of figures? That decision has to be made. Finally, I speculate on a couple of areas where perhaps OSS might be introduced in ATM. First of all, could it be only in non-safety critical systems? Well, I think it's going to be the easier ones to do, at least initially. So you need to have clear lines of responsibility. The buck stops here. Who is it that's responsible for this when this system is put on board an aircraft or is put in an ATC system and then the thing crashes? Who will be in and run this steering committee? How do you decide that? Practically, there's a couple of suggestions. I think that things that fit into this and where it would be fairly straightforward would be in safety and performance analysis tools. These are the sorts of things. It's not safety critical. It's something that would be useful, widely required by the community. And the same sort of thing applies to the real-time and fast-time simulators. Why shouldn't we have a worldwide community that actually develops the professional simulators? There are already amateurs that do this. There are amateur versions of this. Why not go in, pitch in with them, and have an open source Escape, an open source RAMS? These are our in-house proprietary simulators at Eurocontrol. But thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Garfield, for the suggestions. Please.
Easy question, and we need an hour to hear your reply. How do you achieve interoperability, TCAS interoperability?
It's through standards of defining. I say what I'm doing, and I decide on my resolution advisory. I then transmit to you, the other aircraft, what I don't want you to do. I'm climbing, so whatever you do, don't climb, is the message I send to you. The first aircraft that sends that message is the one that will get it correct, and so it will lock things in. And because it's asynchronous operation, normally one aircraft will react before the other. In the very rare occasion that you do get synchronous choice of resolution advisories, and both of them decide to descend, then each aircraft in the world has a number assigned to it called a MODES address. And the one with the lowest MODES address is given priority and it forces the other one to reverse its choice. So they're both told to descend. The one with the lowest MODES address will continue to descend and the one with the higher MODES address says, oh, whoops, I see that the other one is also doing what I'm doing. I've got to reverse. So that in a nutshell is how the interoperability works. There are also similar plans for horizontal things, but there's no horizontal resolution advisory provided.
Yeah. Is that everybody?
Just a comment. The RTCA process you described sounds remarkably similar to the IETF.
the Internet Engineering Task Force who designed Internet Protocol and related issues. Right. So it obviously works quite generally.
And I see the sort of the standard setting process as somewhat useful in this context. I'm sure that ATM regulators are going to require standards to be set, but it's the question is how to make that process more open to the man in the street.
Yeah, the IETF, and similar to what you just described, I think is a very practical and well-proven model, and it does work.
Yeah, there is a big difference between the IETF and the ICAO or ATCA.
Yeah.
They're trying to do things before there is any implementation. The IETF tries to validate implementations.
Mm-hmm.
Because to have an internet standard, you have to have two different and interoperable implementations. Whereas in this kind of committee, you decide on beforehand what you want to do, then it gets implemented. Mm-hmm. It's a completely reverse process.
In practice, sort of the implementation and the standards go hand in hand, because manufacturers started to develop the kit and they put on some algorithm into it, provisional algorithms, to see just how things were working. But at the same time, people were developing alternative algorithms or some modifications, changes to parameters, etc. So I don't think it wasn't entirely as clean as that, but it's broadly isolated.
I think what you said is more like OMG style, object management style, which did all the UML and CORBA standards, for example.
For me, it's not quite clear why you call this approach open source software, because for me it sounds as an example where standardization really works, in contrast to what you said this morning. So it looks as a perfect example where you really can define standards that are applied and work and are interoperable.
What's perhaps interesting is that the standards are at an exceptionally low level. They really are getting down to the engineering details in this case. And perhaps it's interesting to say, well, to what extent can you push the standards down, right down into the detail? Can you set an open source as a standard is perhaps the challenge. You have got something that's been written by the community. Everybody has thrashed the hell out of the bugs as far as they can. Can you say, well, look, the standard is this?
One of the reasons why also we wanted to discuss this or present this to you is because of the social aspects of how these standards come about. They have very much similarities with the communities and the process of open source. Maybe not the result, but the process might be similar. So that's what we would like to discuss as well.
Can I just respond to that last somewhat rhetorical question, but I think it's worth an answer. In my opinion, the answer is very strongly yes, that these groups are putting out a standard to guide the behavior of manufacturers. There's no reason why a community can't participate as well as the manufacturers, maybe not instead of, but as well as manufacturers adhering to the same standard. And in fact, and this goes back to the IETF example as well, and take your point on board, that open source projects actually tend to flourish when there's nice, clearly defined standards. I mean, if you look at the reference implementations of the W3C, or even the work of, the Apache Software Foundation work on things like Tomcat as reference implementations of standards, that this dynamic collaborative process really flourishes when there's a nice, clear path to follow. The other thing I wanted to say just real quick, you asked the question earlier on, is OSS appropriate for safety critical systems? And I know nothing about safety critical systems, so I'll start with that. But what I would say is that the answer is probably the same if you ask the question, is proprietary software appropriate for mission critical systems, safety critical systems? You have criteria in mind in evaluating a proprietary product. They're going to be no more or less stringent in looking at open source. I don't think it changes the nature of the question.
Fair comment.
Happy with that discussion? No burning questions.